science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Sikowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dog, Bunsen. He's the Twitter science dog. This show takes what's best about dog Twitter, the fun and the empathy found there, but also swirls it together with science and education. Every week, we'll take a deep dive into some interesting thing happening in science in the world, as well as look into the world of science around pets. We also have an expert on every single episode that we have an exciting chat with about what they're studying and the impacts for our society. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another podcast episode. Thanks for tuning in this week. Everybody in our household is still safe from COVID. The cases in Red Deer County, where we live, if you're keeping tabs or you want to know, we have only 2 active cases and we have 13 recovered cases. So most of the people who have tested positive for COVID have recovered from it. We haven't had a single death. So areas of Alberta, the province we live in, are the economy is starting to slowly open up again with precautions. There are a couple places which are not opening up the same way. That's the big city to the south of us, Calgary, and another smaller area around a smaller town called Brooks. Their numbers are still pretty high. We have a giant city north of us called Edmonton, and it has very few cases for having as many people living there as they do. Now, that doesn't mean the virus is gone. Our medical officer, Dr. Dina Hinshaw, has been made that very clear. But there are things that are slowly going to be starting to open over the next 3 months. On Friday, all of the teachers of Lindsay Thurber met, and we were brainstorming some things that would happen if we go back to school, what would have to change. So I measured out 2 meters of physical distancing space inside my classroom, and I can only fit about 12 kids in my classroom. And my class sizes for high school class are usually over 30, probably 35 kids to 36 kids. So we would need a quarter of the kids in the school probably to make that safe. You could cut it in third, but to be safe, a quarter. So there's a whole bunch of logistic things that are going to change when school starts up again in September if the numbers remain so low, right? If there's an outbreak, I guarantee you we'll be going right back to the online learning to keep everybody safe. I hope you're safe where you are. On an adorable front, if you saw the little video that we got sent of Beaker, our golden retriever that's going to be joining our family, it will melt your heart. That video, I think, has been viewed over 100,000 times on Twitter. So people really connected with that little dog, and we just can't wait to meet her. It's going to be a while, right? We don't get her till June 6th or 7th. So the wait is on. And if you've been waiting for a Bunsen stuffy, by the time you listen to this, by the time you listen to the podcast, we should have stock updated. They sold out the stock that we had initially. They sold out in about 8 or 9 minutes. And that's at our website. So you can check the website link in the show notes. What's on tap for today? In science news, we're going to talk about a really cool technique to help blind people see again. Sort of, quote unquote, see again. We got a really fun dog science article to go over. And our guest is Sonia Ganeshram, who is probably the youngest guest we've had on the podcast. She's an 18-year-old student, grade 12 student from Texas, who started in middle school something called Tech for Teens to teach coding to kids. She is such an inspiration to talk to. I can't wait to share that conversation with you. Hey, Bunsen, did you hear about the computer that got a little tipsy at a holiday party? Yeah, it was taking screenshots. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at a really cool technique outlined in an article that helps people who are blind potentially see again. I don't know how many people who are listening are visually impaired or would be considered themselves non-sighted or blind. I don't know many people that are, except for my grandpa. And he's unfortunately passed away. He passed away about 6 months ago. But he became blind from complications due to diabetes. And it really changed his life. He's kind of at an age where losing your sight and having to relearn things like anything like Braille was impossible, but there's a whole bunch of techniques that he developed to help himself still enjoy some things. Audiobooks was a great big thing that he loved. And I rigged up this speaker, which had different felt pads on it, which he could touch and up and down the music. And we put a whole bunch of his old oldie goody songs on a really old iPod that just ran around the clock. It was always on playing music. And then all he had to do when he wanted to listen to it was, you know, because he was completely blind, was feel over and then crank the volume up, listen to it, and then crank the volume down. And everything was just, it was always on. So I guess the problem was, it was kind of random whenever he would hit a song. And I remember he was complaining to me about that. He's like, you put the same songs on my iPod. And I'm like, no, there's 90 songs on there, like 100 songs. He's like, I listen to the same songs every day. Come on, can you, like, why are they the same? And then I figured out that it was just the timing. Is there was about 24 hours of songs on this iPod. And he would listen to music after breakfast. And it was just... because it was about the same length of time in the day for it just to repeat itself. It was always repeating the same songs at the same time. So all I had to do was put on random, and then he was a happy camper with that. A really quick story I'm just going to share with you guys. In university, I sat next to a guy in my science degree who was 100% blind. And he had a guide dog, like he had a service dog that helped him around. It was a yellow lab, and his name was Shadow. I don't get why it was named with Shadow, but it was a yellow lab. And in one of the like small group discussions we were having about, you know, we were supposed to do a little bit of pair work or whatever, somebody asked him like what, I forget how we got onto this, but he talked about what happens when he dreams. And he said that because he was born blind, it was something like when he was born, it was some damage to the optical nerve. He's never seen anything. So he has no concept of vision, like what vision even is. So when he dreams... he dreams in sounds and conversations. So nightmares are scary sounds and scary conversations. And that's kind of blew my mind. And it was really, he found it difficult when he was young, when people would try to explain something to him, like, this is what it looks like. Because he had no concept of what looks like even means, right? He understands hearing, but not looks like. So let's talk a little bit about this technique. Visually impaired people in the study, people who were blind, they were able to hook electrodes to their brains to impart a type of vision to see letters and shapes. Now, this is mind-blowing. I didn't even know people were working on this, but this study is just fantastic. It's in the journal Cell in May. That's where this article, the study, comes from. And the process kind of... how do they get the vision to the brain? Is they go around the eyes and the optical nerve. I don't know if you've seen science fiction shows. A good example is in Infinity War, Thor lost an eye, spoiler alert, and Rocket gives him like a fake eye that he just kind of like shoves into his eye hole where his damaged eye was removed or something. I'm not sure how that works. But in science fiction, that's what I always thought it was, is like you just put a new robotic eye into the eye hole and then you're good to go. But what the study was talking about is many times like that optic nerve is destroyed and you're cooked. It doesn't matter if you put a robotic eye in there, the signal isn't getting to the brain. But what they found out is they can go around the brain by delivering electrical signals directly to it. And the idea is you could potentially restore some type of vision this way. We're a long way off of somehow allowing somebody who's non-sighted to see this way. But it doesn't involve, like, it gets around the big problem of damaged eyes or damaged optical nerves. So tiny jolts of electricity are zapped onto the cortex of the brain, the optical cortex of the brain, that understands vision. That's like at the back of the brain. That's the tissue at the back of the brain. This creates small bursts of light called phosphenes. They have been doing this, I guess. They figured out that this is a thing. Maybe that's why when you hit your brain, when you get smoked really hard, you see stars. I got punched really hard. Okay, so I do martial arts. In a martial arts tournament where you spar against people, right? I was winning handily against this other guy and the ref called stop, and the guy was just, it wasn't on purpose, but the ref called stop, and I did the thing you're never supposed to do, is drop your guard. and the guy just clocked me after the ref had called stop to the little battle, and I got blasted in the side of the head, and I saw like a burst of light. I guess these are phosphenes in a way too. So while this has been done before, they never were able to impart a real image to the people who are blind with these electrodes and imparting this zappifying their brain. They got like a mess of moving lights that's kind of like a blob. So they couldn't discern anything. Like, oh, I can see something. What is it? I don't know. Blob. But this time, they were able to impart actual shapes and get the blind person to then take the shapes they saw and redraw them with stunning accuracy. This is so cool. So how did they get the electric signal to the brain? They had to implant electrodes into the brain, so it's a little bit invasive, and then they were activated in sequence by a stylus that basically painted electricity onto the cortex of the brain, kind of like somebody writing on your skin and then you trying to figure out what they drew. After they saw, quote unquote, saw the shape, they had to redraw it, and they were able to redraw 86 shapes correctly within a minute. And those shapes weren't crazy simple. They were letters, right? But they also were faces, houses, cars. So pretty complicated shapes. Simple, right? Like nobody's drawing like a dodecahedron or something like that. But, you know, a face, a happy face with a hat. That's pretty cool. I think that's fantastic. And it was really emotional for the people who were non-sighted when these signals, these like bursts of light kind of like showed up in their brain. But our biology is built to like interpret that. They were like, burst of light. Oh my goodness. Like, what is that? And then they're like, okay, they were able to sort out how to turn that, what their brain was showing them into a 2D image by redrawing it. That's amazing that even though from birth, That part of their body was non-functioning, was destroyed, there was still the part of the brain that was built to make sense of it. And that creates great hope for the future. The researchers were optimistic with what they found, cautiously optimistic. Obviously, this is a big breakthrough. The next idea is potentially trying to make a 3D image, right? If they could somehow figure out how to impart a 3D image to this part of the brain, it is no stretch of the imagination to think of somehow many years from now with a camera and a computer turning a scan of 3D in front of a person quickly into a 3D image of electrical impulses that the non-sighted person sees, in a way imparting a type of vision, or at least like a rudimentary vector diagram of what their world is. I think that's so cool and it's so hopeful. This is the one study this week that I was really, it was number one on my list to talk to everybody about. I think it definitely would have changed. Like, I think my grandpa didn't have sight for about, I think, 6 years, 6 or 7 years. And it was definitely impacted his quality of life. And if you know anybody that's lost their vision, there's a mourning period that goes through. So just like with people who have lost the ability to walk or can no longer hear, it's a big deal of who you are if you lost it. And for people who have never had that before, that's the one thing that this guy that was in my class told us is he didn't want pity from anybody. He just can't see, but he can do other things totally fine. Because of course, if somebody was given the option to see, they'd be like, yeah, I'd kind of like to see. If just out of curiosity, maybe they're like, I don't need to see. I'm good to go. I've learned how to live life as a non-sighted person. But they said they'd be super curious to see what sighted people actually get to see. And the joke is that maybe they'd be able to understand why sighted people call oranges orange. I've heard that from a bunch of people who are blind. Like, that's the dumbest English word. Like, for one, I don't understand what color is. And why would you call a fruit orange? Is an orange really orange? Did you name the orange color after oranges? Like, that's, I find that really funny, and a great sense of humor from a couple of non-sighted people that have made that same joke to me. Okay, well, that's science news for this week. This week in dog science, we're going to take a look at the computing power of the brain of a dog versus the computing power of a brain of a cat. Actually, we're just looking at some really cool studies that have been kind of bundled together into dog and cat intelligence. So how do dog and cat intelligences combine to be similar, or how are they different? Okay, so let's take a look at dogs. Now, most of the dogs on Earth aren't pets. We had a researcher from Darwin's Dogs. It's this awesome survey that anybody can join. And that's one of the things that the researcher was telling us, Kathleen Morrow. She said that most dogs in the world are city dogs, or they're kind of scavenger dogs. And that's true. The 3/4 of the world's dogs aren't pets like Bunsen. And they don't live with humans. They live in the wild. They have to hunt. They have to scavenge. And that's where a dog's memory is really good, and it's for food. While you might forget that you threw, you know, a sandwich into a garbage can, and which garbage can you threw that sandwich in, like a week from now, dogs can remember if they found a sandwich in that area that the sandwich was there, and that's a source of sandwiches. It's like the magical sandwich container. So they will remember that for a long time. Dogs also have a great working memory and a great long-term memory to remember tricks or things like that. When food is involved, dogs can also turn commands from their motivation to get food into a long-term type of memory or working memory. So that's where it's really possible and probable that the early dog-human bonds over food kind of turned into dogs understanding the human's commands, like, go sit there. And they sit there and they get a treat. And the dogs that could do that without fear pass those genes on to their offspring. Another really cool thing about dogs, as I'm looking at Bunsen just being the absolute couch potato on the ground, he's just sleeping, is that dogs have episodic memories. So what is an episodic memory? They're more complicated than long-term memory because they require a bit of self-awareness. Now, we are not sure, dog behavioral scientists are not sure if dogs are self-aware, but they do have episodic memories, which are like a memory of their life in their head. It's like what, where, when details, not just like do this, get that, I'll remember that. It's more like a sitcom that runs in their brain. So in 2016, a study that showed this in Current Biology, they took 17 dogs. And they were taught to kind of like do what a human does, like monkey see, monkey do, like do as I do. So if a human sits on a rug, then the dog was trained to follow what the human did. If the human laid down, the dog had to lay down. So on one of the tasks, after the dog was to lay down, the human added an extra task, like touching an umbrella or giving an unfamiliar command. The human took the dog behind a screen and waited for about a minute to an hour before asking the dog to do, like, to reproduce what the human did with the extra command or extra kind of like activity. Now, not all dogs were able to imitate the human. Like, over the course of the hour, the longer the human waited, the success rate with the dog went down. If it was especially within 10 minutes, 20 minutes, the dogs had a really high success rate. So it shows the dog can say, okay, I was at this point in my life, the human did this, it added that extra command. I'm not sure why they did that, but I'm going to do it too because I get reward for that. One of the last things is that dogs hold extreme long-term memory for things that are very, very important for them. Even though dogs' long-term memory for unfamiliar tasks fade over time, dogs have like insane, their whole life, basically. They can remember things their entire life if it's something that is very, very important to them. And one of the things that is the most important to dogs is their people, like their human family. So there is this owner-dog bond. I don't even want to call it an owner-dog bond. It's like a family. It's like a dog is part of your family. And there's lots of anecdotal cases of where a human has died and the dog has never, ever forgotten that human. I just think that's so heartwarming. That's so adorable. I won't forget my dogs. I won't forget any of the dogs that I've ever, I remember them just like it was yesterday. But on things that aren't as important to them, like if you chuck a ball and they can't find it and they're like, where's the ball? They'll probably forget about the ball unless they're really, really attached to that ball. Okay, so let's talk about cats. Cats have exceptional detailed memory for hunting. They are so good at remembering where to hunt and where food is, just like dogs. They tested cats with, like, here's a bunch of bowls. We're going to put food in a bowl. It's only going to be the red bowl or the bowl with, like, this design on it. Or it's going to be the tall bowl. And only that bowl is going to have food on it. And we're going to take the bowls away from you for 10 minutes and bring them back. And the cats always knew which bowl had the food in it. So cats seem to have a very good short-term working memory. They can remember where and they can remember what. So another thing that cats are really good with when they're younger, is they're good with spatial memory. In a 2008 study that was outlined in the Journal of Applied Animal Behavior Science, cats were given a bunch of different like cups that had food in it. And they found out really quickly that the researchers would never put food in the same cup. So they would go there and like, oh, there's food this time. They would go there, oh, there's not food. And then they would get the idea that I need to check another cup first for food, not go back to the original cup. So they were able to understand that that cup had food sometimes, but this time it wasn't. So that also tracks with hunting potentially, right? The memory may help cats find where prey is, but also, oh, I already looked for food in this area and it wasn't there before. So it's probably not there tonight. So I need to go hunt somewhere else. One of the problems with cat brains and cat intelligence, their short-term memory is pretty short for things that aren't necessarily food related. So probably most studies have an average of about a 30-second memory for cats. So if you hide something on a cat, it'll care for the first 10 seconds about the thing you hid. But after about 30 seconds, it's like it never happened. And in a study from 2006, the researchers outlined that cats having terrible long-term memory or having like extreme short-term memory probably helps them with hunting. Like if a mouse gets away and it hides under some leaves, they're not going to go expending calories hunting for it. It's gone. They're going to go find some other mouse. The odds are low that it's going to be there a minute from now. So what's the point? That's really different from dogs. I don't know if you've had a dog where like a treat or something has gone under a table and they are just going to keep going at that, trying to get that treat all day long. They do not forget if it's food. If you're a cat lover or if you're a dog lover, if you love both, it's kind of neat just to learn a little bit about how their brains work and where they're good and where they're bad at intelligence. We can all agree that they're just adorable, even if you got one that's a couple sandwiches short of a decent picnic. Okay, that's dog science for this week. Before we get to the interview section, I just want to tell everybody about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible by listeners just like you. The podcast will always be free to download. You're never going to have to worry about paying for it. This has been one of the greatest decisions of my life to start this podcast, just from personally and professionally how much I've grown getting to talk to all these amazing people and getting to know people who listen to the show. But the show isn't free to run, and if you want to support it, head over to the Patreon page at patreon.com/Bunsenburner. You'll notice that there's different tiers of support, and the lowest tier is only $5 a month. At 4 shows a month and $5 a month, that's not that expensive for good educational entertainment. We also send out swag to our patrons and give them awesome patron-only content and early access, like getting onto the website early for Bunsen, and top-tier patrons got a Bunsen stuffy shipped to them. The link is in the show notes if you want to head over there and check it out. Thanks for listening, guys. On to the interview section. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I'm so excited to have Sonia Ganeshram. How are you doing today, Sonia?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am good. Now, you are probably the youngest person we've had on the Science Podcast. How old are you, Sonia?
I'm 18 years old.
Oh my goodness. Now, we're going to get into why your story is so cool in a second. But where, just so people know where, I guess we're talking to you from, where are you calling to the podcast from?
I'm located in North Texas.
So you are just graduating high school, as we were kind of talking about that.
Yes, I'll be graduating, hopefully over the summer.
And with all of the pandemic that's occurring, everything's online. And that's got to be a struggle with some of your classes, I'd imagine.
Yes. It's been a little bit hard to make the transition, but I think the teachers are putting in a lot of effort and, they're trying to make themselves as available to us as possible. So Things are kind of running pretty well. Not without its like little bumps in the road, but other than that.
I'm a high school teacher myself, and the transition has been a ton of work. Actually, I think way more work than when kids are in front of you, because when you have kids in front of you, if somebody has a question, it's super easy to answer it. But it's really awkward doing that online when some kids are struggling and trying to explain things. Mm-hmm. I teach chemistry. So what we found really works, I don't know if your teachers are doing this too, is I make stupid little videos of me teaching. And I make them super goofy and awkward and uncomfortable so the kids tune in. Because you could just post stuff to like Khan Academy, which is amazing. But I think having the teachers talk about it, even if we're not as good, it gives you that personal experience. Do you guys do like Zoom or Google Meets with your teachers?
Yeah, we're actually doing Google Meets. But ours are a little bit different. They're not necessarily for instruction purposes, but more for like office hours.
Yep.
So we'll get a lot of work over the week. And then if we have any questions, we'll meet with our teacher at a specific time.
That's exactly what we're using Google Meets for as well. And then the funny thing is if all the kids don't mute their mics, when one kid asks a question, it like has this crazy feedback effect. So that's one of the things I don't think Google Meets was ready for, was having like 40 or 50 people on at the same time with their mics on. You know, you're in a situation that's probably quite different than most people in this pandemic. But let's talk about who you are and maybe why your story is so interesting for the podcast. What talk to us about, I guess, where the story for Tech for Teens came from. That's what you're really connected to. Mm-hmm. And that's so fascinating. I'll let you explain it.
So around the time I was in middle school, I became really interested in coding. At the time, we didn't necessarily have classes at my school to take, and I found it super interesting. My brother was a software engineer. Lo and behold, my mom isn't currently a software engineer, but I learned around that time that her past job was being a software engineer. So, you know, they kind of helped me take that passion and run with it. I found like these programs in Dallas, which was about 2 hours from where I live, that I was really interested in and I really wanted to go to learn more about coding. And my parents, you know, because they're so supportive, you know, decided to make like the 2-hour commute on some weekends to take me down there and to learn more. And I kind of just recognized that in my small city, there just wasn't, a lot of students wouldn't have access to be able to go and drive so often on weekends, especially at my school, where a majority of kids at the time were like low income. It was really important to me to be able to bring that opportunity to my community. And I started getting in touch with my middle school at the time, and I set it up sort of as a club. And we all just kind of talked about code, and I taught them, you know, different programs and different activities and different functions. And from there on, it kind of just grew. The local university reached out to me and we started to set it up over there to open it up to the entire public. And, you know, we usually have around a total of 50 kids between the two classes every year. And, you know, we reel in some more for the big events we do. And I think it's made a really great impact on the community. I've taught a lot of like the students that we had to become teachers and to get involved with the program that way, so that way it can continue once I go off to college.
Oh, what an inspirational story. So did it start kind of, was it like a snowball rolling down a hill? I know that's kind of a difficult, that's a Canadian analogy, but did it start with a small group of kids and then as word got out, more joined? Or was there like a quick, immediate buy-in from your middle school?
Yeah, so with my middle school in particular, we had very few kids at the beginning. I think there was about like 6 in total. And sometimes, like even at the MSU, like the university program, we can have like a low number of kids just depending on like the week, because kids kind of come and go as they want. But I remember my first class at MSU, which was the local university, was a complete shock because there was like 30 kids or 40 kids in there and we didn't have enough chairs for everyone. And people were standing up and some kids couldn't get a computer and parents were standing up in the back. And I think, like, at that point, STEM was such a hot topic and coding was such a hot topic that it just got a lot of buy-in from the community, and it was really exciting. And we've been lucky enough to sort of, like, continue that and, like, host events where we can bring in more kids. So, yeah.
So when you brought it back to your middle school to start with, did you talk to some of your teachers and you're like, hey, this is a good idea? And did they jump in with you to help? Or were you kind of like given, okay, here's the classroom, good luck with it, fill your boots kind of thing?
Well, I actually like reached out to my middle school science teacher. Her name was Miss Gallenberger. And I asked her if I could like start this club with her. And she was really into it. Even though she wasn't like super experienced in coding or anything, she was super supportive and gave me the space. And sometimes when kids would like come in there and like cause a ruckus, as like middle school kids do, she would step in and, you know, help me keep it going. And she was just really supportive of it the entire time. Yeah.
What are some of the things you teach and like programs or skills or things that you do in Tech for Teens? Like if you could walk us through something that you would do, that would, you know, not a lot of people understand computers or coding at all. Mm-hmm. It's like magic to them.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of how it is to a lot of kids. A lot of kids go in either with like really low expectations that they're not going to be able to do anything, or like really high expectations that they're going to be able to like write a few lines of code and make a whole video game. but basically we teach two languages, kind of like three, but we teach JavaScript and then we also teach HTML and CSS as like one sort of course. And we have like an introductory JavaScript, and then every year our advanced class switches off between the HTML class and the, advanced JavaScript class. And within that, we teach them a lot of, like, at the very beginning, they're doing very basic things, like learning how to draw pictures in JavaScript and learning how to do some basic functions that, like, will output, like, some random numbers or some random words. You know, every week we teach them a concept. Like, for example, the first week when we teach them how to draw something, then we say, okay, go draw a person on your own. And they do that for about half the class. And then the next week we pick up with that person. And this time we're like, okay, let's add color to our person. And this is how you do it. And so every week you're just sort of building up in a very nice way on those skills. And it makes a lot of like cohesive sense because everything kind of goes together.
It's like you've been doing this for a lifetime. You've just described the scaffolding that experienced teachers go through in teaching concepts. That's amazing. The one thing I was going to mention is that I think that's a misconception for some kids who are really interested in video games, that coding for video games and making a video game isn't like an overnight process. It takes sometimes years and years. But it is good to show kids, I guess, that there's a little itty bitty bit that you can build upon to make something very cool by the end. Mm-hmm. This class, this Tech for Teens, is it a club or do kids get credit for it, or is it something that is built into their timetables now?
Well, so it's sort of like an after school program that we host at the local university. They don't get credit for it, but a lot of kids, it's sort of like a club, but it's more of a class because we teach them. But no, it's not like a by credit class.
Okay, I gotcha. It's so admirable that you started something like that. I'm just trying to think what I was doing in middle school. And it was probably, like, I'm quite a bit older, but probably if I had time in middle school, I would be on a computer somewhere playing the Oregon Trail and trying not to let my family die of dysentery. Not thinking about running some class like you did. That's so, so amazing. Has this kind of process of teaching this to kids lined you up for post-secondary now that you're looking at being done high school? Like, is that where you're looking at going?
Well, I'm not looking at going into education necessarily. But one thing that I've noticed is that I've always been really interested in like advocacy and sort of working with the community and, helping kids and helping, like the community with education. And so definitely like in the university, I'm planning on working with nonprofits, and continuing to do that. because it's something that's like really valuable to me and something that I really enjoy. As far as university, I just have sort of like no idea what I want to do right now, which I think is pretty normal.
It's normal.
So I'm hoping to figure that out by my sophomore year of college, but we'll just see.
I think in my last year of, I tell this to my students too, because I teach a lot of grade 12s in high level chemistry, right? And they come to me for advice and I'm like, man, you know what? When I was in my last year, I went through like four different things. I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to maybe try to get into something with kinesiology. And then I settled on chemistry. So like the, you have a lot of time. Life is very long. So don't panic too much. That's what I tell them. You just got to find something you're interested in, because university can be very tough if you're not interested in what you're studying.
So definitely.
What got you so passionate about coding? What was the thing that drew you into this in the first place?
Right. So I've always been a super like creative and artistic person, but I like learned sort of about coding through a lot of the initiatives that were going on to promote women in STEM. And one thing that really interested me in coding was the fact that you could create basically anything you wanted to. You can create art, you can create entertainment, you can create, you know, tools and devices for people to use. And it is such a sort of like baseline skill to have if you want to do anything involving creating something within the technology field. So every time I would do a new program or do a new like function or figure out how to do an assignment, I would get this really like great sense of gratification, because it's like an uphill battle. Coding is such an uphill battle, because sometimes when you're making stuff, there's no information on what you're doing out in the universe, because you're creating new things. So you can't go on the internet and look up like exactly how to do something that you want to do. So a lot of it is like trial and error and figuring out the most efficient and most effective way to do it. And it's really, really like a great feeling once you accomplish that.
That's so cool you mentioned that. I've talked to a couple astrophysicists on the show, and both of them have had to actually teach themselves coding to build programs to analyze the data that they get in. Mm-hmm. One of the astrophysicists, she taught herself coding in working while she's working on her PhD to analyze dark matter. Mm-hmm. And she's, when she was explaining to me, it's kind of what you're telling me too. It's almost like coding is a form of art, and you don't see the final end point of how amazing it is until you're done. And you're just like, wow, that was an amazing painting that I just painted. But the painting in this case is XYZ that you've coded.
Right.
Ah, very cool. I know maybe I didn't get a final answer out of you, but even though you're not, your mind's not made up for university, is going into computer science something you'd be interested in?
Well, to an extent, I'm interested in taking a few classes at least and broadening my horizons and knowledge in it, because there's always something to learn.
Right.
In coding, it's just so infinite. And I know that like Harvard is very renowned for their CS50 class. So that's something I'm planning on taking. And I've been working on with a couple of other pre-freshmen on like the problems for their CS50 puzzle day. And it seems like sort of one of those classes you just have to take. If you go to the university, you have to take it. So I'm definitely planning on taking like a couple of computer science classes, hopefully.
Do you play or play video games or play apps on your phone? Was that where some of the coding came from? Or was it just the, like you said, the holistic kind of creativity of it?
Right. Well, I was like super into like, at the time I was really young. So I was really into like social media, because that was a big thing that I just started to get into. And I was like, wow, it would be so cool to like design apps for like phones and stuff. And even though that wasn't the immediate starting point, because obviously like apps versus like introductory like coding are on two different levels. that's kind of what sparked it for sure.
That paints a really good picture of where your passion came from. And explaining tech for teens is, I'm just so in awe of what you were able to accomplish when you were so young.
Thank you.
One of the things we ask our guests for in the middle of the interview is for a pet story. Do you have a pet story or an animal story you could share with us?
Well, I don't necessarily have a story, but I have a little like tidbit to share. So I have a dog. His name's Bolt. He's a Pomeranian, and he's very fluffy. Aww. And very small, very cute. He's 8 years old, but he still acts like a puppy. But over his 8 years of life, he's definitely learned to pick up on a lot of the things we say and use them for his advantage. One of those things is that he's learned my dad is a sucker for giving him table food. So he's figured out and like mapped out the schedule when my dad comes home at night. And he, every day when he hears like the bell, to like the alarm system opening like the garage or something, he immediately knows it's my dad and he starts barking like crazy and running around the kitchen. And it's just really funny. Like he's just so intelligent and has figured out so much of like what we do and how to manipulate us.
Now, do you know if your family, when they were deciding to get a dog, were like, we are not feeding this dog table scraps? And was your dad the loudest voice and then his heart has softened over the years?
Well, actually, we kind of got the dog on like a spur of the moment sort of thing. And my dad was like the person that's like, we're not getting the dog. But oh. He's the one who's the most lenient to him for everything. So, yeah,
that's usually the way it goes, is that the dogs just worm right into your heart.
Mm-hmm.
they're like little people.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your dog's name again?
His name is Bolt. So it's like the
Bolt
movie.
Okay. Like the movie Bolt. Yeah, I was wondering.
We actually didn't name him after the movie, though. I named him Bolt because I wanted to name him Harry Potter, but my mom was like, that's way too long, way too weird. So I was like, okay, well, Harry Potter has a lightning bolt scar. And then my dad wanted to name him Bolt because he runs very fast. So it's like Usain Bolt.
Oh, there you go. So it's got a whole bunch of, that's a cool story for your dog.
Yeah.
We named Bunsen Bunsen because he's a Bernese Mountain Dog. And the short for Bernese Mountain Dog is a burner. Right. So being a chemistry guy, then we got a Bunsen burner.
So. That's cute.
The one thing about Bunsen with table scraps is we try not to give him table scraps. He can't jump, though. I don't know what it is about Bernese Mountain Dogs. They're just like too solid.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't like jumping up on his back legs.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's so big, if you're sitting down in a chair, he'll sit down and he's almost eye level with you.
Oh.
Because he's just so massive, right? Like if you're sitting mm-hmm. in a lounge chair, so he'll just sit at you and stare at you, and he has these moves to try and make you feel so guilty to try and get some food from you. I don't know if Bolt does that too with your dad. Probably.
Oh, he definitely. He's very vocal, so he barks a lot.
Well, thanks for sharing your story about Bolt. That's an adorable little tidbit. So one of the questions I was going to ask you is, it's kind of a deep question, and it's not one that I have any answers for because I'm so removed from like understanding the coding of tech. I use tech every day, but coding it is just like almost magic to me. It just happens and I'm happy. Can parents and teachers do a better job of teaching tech to kids? Where do you think that society could improve on making that connection?
Well, one thing that a lot of people like call us is iGen, because we grew up with like the cell phones in our hands. And I think a big part of like the tech barrier a lot between like older people and like the younger generations is that the younger generations are so like involved in tech, that a lot of the times you can learn things from like younger people. And I think just allowing young people to share their experiences and what they know about technology with like older generations is really helpful. And I think that that's a way that you can sort of bridge that gap. But at the same time, I think it's really important for like even older generations to learn about the advancements of tech and sort of relate that to like their students and what their students know about tech, because even myself, like I teach kids that are only like 7-6 years younger than me, but sometimes they'll teach me something completely new, or sometimes they'll make me feel like I'm old because I don't know like how to work something on the computer.
Oh no.
But that's just a part of it, because young people are so ingrained in tech that they've like learned everything about it. And I think another thing is just definitely being cognizant of like what your kids do online and learning how to monitor that better while still giving them like their personal space, because for them, that is a social space and it's turned into a social space. But just like any social space, like if you ask your kid, like you wouldn't want your kid going to a party really late at night. There's still like some barriers that you need to keep in mind. And yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing that a lot of, like, as a teacher, we know a little bit about what goes on in that more than maybe some parents do, that social media can sometimes have and be turned into a very negative and ugly space. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that that shocked me was, like, sometimes the kids are up really late, so they'll have, like, an online party at, like, 1 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning where they're just, like, chatting and talking to each other, and, man, you need to be sleeping then.
Right.
How are you going to function the next day?
Right.
That's really funny. You mentioned that, that technology changes so fast, mm-hmm. that you are maybe getting outpaced by kids that are 9 years younger than you. Mm-hmm. I found that really hilarious, 'cause I've got a younger, my youngest sister's a bit younger than me, like a decade younger. Mm-hmm. And she was like all up on Instagram before I even could really wrap my head around what Instagram was. This is a while ago, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, what, Instagram? What is Instagram? She's like, oh, it's pictures. I'm like, so it's Facebook? And she's like, no, it's not Facebook. It's pictures. I'm like, well, you can put pictures on Facebook. Right. And then now she's been outpaced by the next generation of kids using like other types of social media and sharing. Mm-hmm. The big one the kids were all over this year was TikTok.
Yeah,
sure. TikTok was huge. It just kind of came out of nowhere, and there's kids shooting little TikTok videos for whatever. They were very jealous. I made a TikTok account for Bunsen, and in 2 days it had more followers than just about the entire Chem 30 class combined, because he's so popular on social media. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm doing with TikTok, but anyways.
Yeah, it's a weird platform to learn, especially if you're like not a part of that weird Gen Z humor, because that's what's like populating that app, is just really young people.
I just steal other ideas that make sense. Like some of them don't make sense at all. I do appreciate I have to say I do appreciate the younger generation's ability to make humor out of the technology. Like the humor and memes and things like that have gotten so good, as long as they're not like harmful or hurtful. Mm-hmm. But the really on the nose type memes are mm-hmm. it's coming from the younger kids in younger generations, and it's actually a whole new area of humor, which I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. I mean, all I've got in my arsenal is really bad dad jokes, so I think we could probably improve the humor for some of us,
right?
What's your favorite social media app? Like what do you like to use?
Oh wow. So I really enjoy using Snapchat to an extent, but like I feel like I use everything for different things. Probably spend most of my time browsing through either TikTok or Instagram. Because I just love watching all the funny videos on TikTok. They're hilarious to me.
Yeah, some of them are pretty good.
Yeah, and then just sharing them with my friends and yeah, I like talking, like, or I like taking photos on Instagram and posting them on Instagram and messaging friends on Instagram. And then Snapchat is just more like casual, and I just like talking to my friends, sending pictures. Like, but really, I just like kind of use everything. I mean, I use Facebook as like more of a professional space, and then I use like.
It's funny how that's become the professional space. But yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I use Facebook as like more of a professional space. Instagram's like slightly more personal. Snapchat's like only for my friends. And then TikTok is just like for entertainment purposes. Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it.
What the kids have told me is TikTok is like the new YouTube like for entertainment almost.
For sure.
Interesting. Well, it's cool to chat with you about that and get your perspective. I don't have these conversations with my students because I think that would be very awkward. I'm sit down with some Chem 30 kids. I'm like, yo, hey, what do you think of the TikTok? And they'd be like, get out of here, old man. One of the questions we always ask our guests near the end of the interview is for the super fact. And the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of blows their mind. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
Yeah. So a big thing that's like really pertinent in code right now is sort of the disparity between the amount of women involved in coding and the amount of men involved in coding. And many people are really surprised to know that the first ever like computer programmer was a woman, and her name was Ada Lovelace. And she programmed on like some of the first huge supercomputers that would like take up the space of like an entire like room, like large room, or like living room.
Was it ENIAC, or was like the ENIAC type like giant classroom size computers that she was working on?
Yeah. So like it was more like around the time where, the computers were like, really mechanical.
Oh yes. Okay. You're right. They weren't run by electricity per se. They were mechanical machines. Okay. Yeah. So that was way before ENIAC.
Yeah. I gotcha. So like those, the algorithms sort of like big machines. Yeah. And they were like just mechanical, purely mechanical.
Gotcha. Okay. So I apologize. I was wrong. I'm sorry about that. You know, it's funny. My wife has a poster of women in STEM, or like people from history. And it's really cool poster because they're all the women are kind of looking up, and it's mm-hmm. cartoonish. Mm-hmm. And she's on there, and it says underneath her, they have all got little words underneath them. Like hers is compute.
Oh, so cool.
I've got the pop culture one in my classroom. The kids love it, of all the women of pop culture. Mm-hmm. The bottom left one is Dana Scully from the X-Files, and hers mm-hmm. is Question. Mm-hmm. There's Leslie Knope from Parks and Rec. I don't know if you've ever seen Parks and Rec.
I love Parks and Rec. One of my favorite shows.
Yeah. So it's her, and her says Care. So it's all of the women from, it's a really cool poster. The kids like trying to figure out who the different characters are. Mm-hmm. I probably should get a more, you know, realistic one, like with Ava Lovelace and my hero, Marie Curie, mm-hmm. than the pop culture one.
Yeah. I mean, that would be cool.
Well, thanks for sharing that super fact. This probably leads us into something that you're really passionate about that maybe you could give us your perspective on, and that is women in STEM and bringing more women into the field. That seemed, you mentioned that was a passion of yours.
Yeah. So actually, when I initially started going to these coding programs, they were primarily for the purpose of promoting young women in STEM. So I was a part of an organization called Girls Who Code. And the whole point of that was just bridging this huge gender gap between the amount of women in CS and the amount of men in CS. And even today, like if you walk into a room for like a coding contest, you'll be like one of the six females. But it's crazy to see how much we've grown in the field, because when I first started doing coding contests, like my freshman year of high school, I would be the only girl in the entire room, and I wouldn't like, there wouldn't be another girl in there. People would kind of like, the guys would look at me weird, like, oh, what is she doing here? But then like now I walk into a coding contest and I see like at least 25% of the people in there are women. And ideally we'd get to that 50-50, but I really do think that we're like on the track to getting there. Especially as we sort of challenge the idea that women can only be like relegated to very specific positions and very specific jobs. And we're seeing like more women as innovators and as analytical thinkers. And hopefully like in the next 10 to 15 years, we'll see women who are like CEOs of big tech companies, and seeing women pave that path. Just completely in the STEM field, not just in like tech, but in like science and engineering and mathematics. Like seeing the growth of women into these like really analytical jobs that originally like they were not supported to be in. And also seeing like a huge support base develop for these women and organizations that are there to educate more women and get them more involved in these programs.
I think probably another big part of this also is when you're teaching these classes, and I imagine you have girls younger than you that are listening mm-hmm. to you teach, man, you yourself as a role model to them, they must think, well, if she's the teacher, mm-hmm. then it's possible for me. That's a space that I can exist in as well. Mm-hmm. That's so powerful. Just to give you an idea, I've noticed in the last probably decade of teaching, more and more girls are taking the sciences. My chemistry classes, probably the last 4 or 5 years, have been a 60-40 split, 60% wow. girls, 40% boys. So, mm-hmm. And we are seeing that shift for sure. Mm-hmm. And then when we have all voices, we have much better collective, I guess, problem solving.
Yes, agreed completely.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I think you made a good point that if you're really interested in something with technology, there's a space for you. Mm-hmm. When I was your age, I was big into video games. So the only thing I would be concerned about is learning how to make a video game. But mm-hmm. now everything is so engaged ingrained in technology. It would be fascinating to be on the next social media app team, or you developed that yourself. That'd be so cool.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we're kind of at the end of the interview. Thanks so much for talking to us about your initiative with Tech for Teens and your words of wisdom from a generation probably a little bit younger than the listening base of the Science Podcast. Does your organization have a social media account or page that people could follow?
Yes. So on Facebook, we're Tech for Teens, and you can find us pretty easily. Just search the three keywords, and that's also our handle as well. So
awesome. I'll make sure there's a link to that in the show notes to the show when the podcast airs. I guess we're kind of at the end. Thanks so much for talking to us. I wish you nothing but the best of luck navigating the next couple years of your life. Just kind of figuring out your place in the world and trying to get through this a pandemic mess between finishing your school and finding your next post-secondary spot. It's probably going to be a little different, but I'm sure with your drive and skill set, you'll get through.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
No problem. It was my absolute pleasure. Every time I talk to guests, I get inspired, and your story has really inspired me. And I hope people listening are also inspired as well.
Thank you so much.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN 10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have a guest host today. It is Yoab, a student from Lindsay Thurber. How are you doing today, Yoab?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me here.
Yay. Now, are you doing okay with this whole shutdown COVID online learning thing?
Definitely, it's gotten better. At first, it was obviously really weird to kind of transition into this kind of online platform. But now I'm kind of actually, I have to say, liking it a little bit. Setting my own schedules and being able to have like all this free time is definitely a plus. And, you know, all my exams are pretty much canceled. So that's a fun thing.
Right. Yeah. You're a grade 12 student and all the grade 12 diplomas and finals were canceled. Just because I don't know how they would safely get all of you guys in a room to write it anyways.
Yeah, definitely. That would have been a problem. So I was originally a little bit disappointed, but I figured out how to do the marks and stuff for next year. So not worried anymore.
So are you one of the students that has a big sleep in the morning and then gets going about noon? Because Zareen was on last week, and I think that's how she runs her schedule.
I don't know. I feel that myself, my body just automatically wakes up around 9 a.m. in the morning, no matter how late I sleep. So I don't know. I guess it senses that I have school and it immediately wakes me up. So I get started pretty early in the morning and stay up pretty late.
Are you part of the Animal Crossing craze? I was going to say you're probably not.
No, I'm not. I don't know if I should join or not because I see everyone playing it, but it seems kind of weird and scary.
Do you know what you're doing next year? Because you're going to be graduated, right? You had plans to do some post-secondary.
Yes, definitely. I applied and got into a Bachelor of Pharmacology program. So that's what I'm thinking of pursuing.
Being a pharmacist or something past that point?
Potentially, yeah, a pharmacist. So I just want to see how that bachelor goes, because I definitely did really enjoy kind of like that medicinal chemistry unit we did back in my grade 11 year. So I just want to see what happens with that first and then decide if a pharmacist is a ongoing career path that I want to pursue.
Very cool. Well, you said the special word to me, which is chemistry. So I'm all happy with that. So sadly, woo or wow this week, the theme is not chemistry or pharmacology. Okay. I know. Zareen got chemistry last week because the guest was a chemist. In woo or wow this week, the theme is computers, because our guest Sonia is she's actually 18 years old, the guest this week, and she started a whole program called Tech for Teens in middle school that teaches kids how to code.
That's actually really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. So how much do you know about computers, Yoab?
Not a lot, but I'll see what I can do.
Okay, so as a recap, I'll be reading three statements. Two of them are fake, they're woo, and one of them is true, it's a wow. Are you ready?
Yes, let's do this.
Now, right, I'd probably listen to all three before you make a final decision. Don't jump the gun too soon.
Okay.
The first statement. The first computer ever made weighed about a ton, and that's a metric ton.
Okay.
All right, so that's a heck of heavy computer.
I feel like that's true. But I'll wait for others.
Right, yeah. You were probably in elementary and middle school with the colorful Mac computers. Were you around when the really colorful ones were?
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing those in like my third grade classroom and thinking they were like so cool and awesome. But here we are now.
All right. The second statement. People blink more when they use a computer.
Okay. I feel like that's false.
You know, you think people blink less?
Yeah, I feel like you just kind of like stare and dry it. Because I always have my eyes dried out after I finish looking at the computer for a while.
That's good anecdotal evidence. But let's move on to the third statement. The first computer mouse was made of wood.
Okay. All right.
Do you want me to recap?
Yes, please.
All right. The first computer ever made weighed about one ton. The second statement, people blink more when they use a computer. And the third statement, the first computer mouse was made of wood.
Okay. So I think that the first one is a woo, because I've seen like in movies and stuff, like how they imagine the first computers and they're like these really like huge entities that take up like a whole room. So I feel like it's more than a ton.
Okay.
And then the second one, based on what I've experienced and how like dry my eyes feel when I'm watching screens and stuff, I'm going to have to say that's also a woo. And then for the third one, by process of elimination, I'm saying that's a wow.
I kind of think like that third one, if it is true, I think people would want a mouse now made of wood just to be kind of hipster with it. Just to be cool.
I would definitely want that.
So you think your eyes dry out more when you're staring at a screen or using a computer, like after one of your big essays or your IAs in science?
Yeah, definitely. I just kind of like feel like my eyes are dried out and everything, and that I haven't blinked a lot. So that's what I'm going to base it off of, my own experience.
Final answer. The third one is the wow.
Yes.
Let's take a look at the one that you think for sure is the untrue statement. People blink more when they use a computer. You are correct. That's absolutely false. People blink way less when they use computers. People blink about 20 times a minute normally. How many times a minute do you think you blink when you're using a screen?
5 or 10, like half of that.
Pretty good. It's 7. It's about 7 times. Yeah, so much less. It's probably why your eyes get scratchy and feel gross. So that means we're down to the first statement about the weight of a computer and the last statement about a mouse made of wood. Let's take a look at that first statement. You thought that the first computers weighed way more than a ton. And that statement is woo. You're correct. You've won. Yay. You won woo or wow, Yoab. The first computer weighed about 27 tons. So significantly wow. more than a ton. Yeah, it was the size of a room, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay. Because I was remember watching lots of like videos and movies where they just have like these huge computers. And I was like, I feel like that weighed more than a ton.
And the first mouse was made by a computer engineer named Doug Engelbart. And it was made of wood and it was created in 1964.
Maybe we should bring that back.
Yeah, an elegant mouse, right?
Mm-hmm. I would like that.
I love using a mouse. I hate using a trackpad. Like a trackpad on a Chromebook? Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, I hate it. Yeah, they're the worst.
Definitely really annoying.
Hey, so Thurber students are 2 for 2. That's amazing. So Zareen got it and you got it. So good job. People are gonna be pretty impressed.
Thank you. I'm proud. I didn't know if I was gonna pass this or not, so I hope someone else can continue the streak after me.
You'll have to let Zareen know. She'll be so happy.
Yeah, I definitely will. I'll go and brag about it too.
All right. It was good to have a chat with you, Yoab. And I guess keep on doing your online learning and good luck in the, I guess I might not even see you till, man, probably till COVID's over, but take care.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you so much. And I'll come visit.
Okay. Perfect. See ya.
Bye-bye.
It's time for the mailbag with me, Adam. You know what time it is. It's the mailbag time. And if you're new and if you don't know what time it is, it's 7:41. And it's time for the mailbag, which is you ask us questions on Twitter and we answer them. The first question is, what does Bunsen do during quarantine? Is he different? What's up with Bunsen? Bunsen during quarantine is very, very sleepy and cuddly and cute and nice and everything in the morning. He's so very tired. He sleeps on the floor. And what you can do is you can just like kind of grab him and then boom, you've got a stuffed animal, but it's real. But during the nighttime, like around 6, like 5, 6, he becomes really angry if he hasn't gone on a walk. But that's not very different from normal Bunsen, because normal Bunsen is always angry at like 6 o'clock because he either hasn't gone on a walk yet or he hasn't had food yet. He is a toddler.
Would you describe him as angry?
No, I would explain him as cranky.
Yeah, it's more of a cranky cry, whine. He needs attention, even though he's had attention all day.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're home. You and I are home, Adam, and mm-hmm. you are able to just hang out with him, and I'm able to hang out with him. And so he has us all day. So mm-hmm. it's not like we're in school.
Yeah.
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 So it's like the more he gets, the more he wants.
Yeah. It's like, it is like a toddler. If you give a toddler a toy, they're going to want another toy and another one and another one. Bunsen in quarantine isn't too much different from regular Bunsen. He's kind of like the same, but also different. The other questions are questions about Beaker. So do you want to answer some of the questions about Beaker, Dad?
Yeah, you bet. So people on Twitter have been asking a lot of questions of Beaker since we posted the little video of her. And it was the most, she is so adorable. But one of the questions people asked was, why did we go with a golden retriever puppy instead of another type of dog? And it probably comes from two things. Before Bunsen, we had a golden retriever named Callan. And she was the first family dog that we had, and definitely she was part of our heart. So we've had a golden before, and their personalities are different than Bernese Mountain Dogs. Not that we love Bunsen so much, and there's so many good things about his personality, but we also wanted another dog with a slightly different personality. At least that's what I was thinking too. And we also wanted a dog that was hardy in the winter. So we wanted a shaggier dog because Callan, before Bunsen, did pretty good in the winter. There was only when it got really, really cold did she not like the winter. She loved going on snowshoeing and she liked skiing. So we're getting Beaker on June 6th or June 7th. And we get updated every Thursday with a picture or a video of her. So watch for that on Bunsen's Twitter. The other question people were asking is if we are going to make an account for Beaker. And I don't think we will. I don't think I have time to run all those social media accounts. But what I think we might do is meld Bunsen and Beaker together on Instagram, because then that's a more natural fit for all the pictures that we're going to have. Whereas Bunsen on Twitter is more of a voice himself, like a Muppet. That's just what I think. We'll play it by ear. What do you think, Chris?
To be absolutely honest, I'm excited about having a little bit more estrogen in the house. And actually, because I knew what we were getting into with a female golden retriever, although Beaker will have a different personality than Callan did, I did a little bit of a poll on my social media asking about what we should be thinking of. Should we be thinking of a male or a female? And there was a lot of interesting results. One person suggested, well, if you get a male, they might just start peeing all over everything. And I thought, what? Bunsen never peed on anything. But then she said, when two of them get together, you know, you never know what you're going to get. We decided to go with a female. And it might be a little bit challenging because we're not trying to replace Callan by any stretch of the imagination, but having another female might pull at our heartstrings in a different way. But we're super excited, and she's going to be so cute and so adorable. And Jason's absolutely correct. She will have different personality traits that are different from Bunsen, and we're looking forward to having a water dog. Bunsen's not interested in the water.
He does not like the water, hey?
At all.
Oh no, Bunsen hates the water.
So, well, I think we're going to have the best of both worlds. And then who knows, maybe a few years down the road, we'll get another puppy, and then another puppy, and then another puppy.
We're gonna run out of science things.
We'll run out of things, yeah.
That's been the mailbag with me, Adam. Time to close up the mailbag. Thank you for voting on the poll on Twitter, and hopefully we will have more mailbags in the future. See you next time. Bye-bye.
And as the sun sets today, it sets on the end of this episode of the podcast. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen. And special thanks to our patrons. The top-tier patrons get a shout-out at the end of the show. And they are Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Shelby Legat, Daniel Fry, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Judith Morton, Karen Beth St. George, Catherine Lynch, Kathleen Zerker, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Ben Rathert, Liz Button, and Rebecca Rutherford. Thanks, patrons. We couldn't do what we do without your support. Also, special thanks to our expert this week, Sonia Ganeshram, who talked to us about her initiative in middle school to bring coding to kids and being just an overwhelming inspirational success story. We can't wait to hear what's in your future, Sonia. And that is all we got, so let's finish with Bunsen's motto. For science, empathy, and cuteness.